From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, the 15th installment of a conversation that we've been having with Professor Luciana Bone about the political economy of the Soviet Union. And where we left off last week was somewhere between Red Vienna and Austrofascism, and so we'll pick up in Red Vienna. Welcome back.
Thank you, Don. So, yeah, the topic today is Red Vienna. And the nickname Red Vienna was given to the social democratic administration of the capital of Austria between 1919 and 1934. So the question that should preoccupy us is, you know, how strong is social democracy, or how strong was social democracy in the context of European and worldwide capitalist crisis in the 1929, and a Europe in the grip of fascism. How strong can social democracy be without a police and army and without seizing the means of production? Is that
right?
Make sense?
Yes.
Okay. So for the Communist Third International, that's the one that comes before the 1935 one, which calls for a united front. But anyway, for the Communist Third International, which was acting during the 1928-29 crisis, for the Third International and Moscow, its social democracy is not very strong under the brunt of fascism. So we know that in the end, in 1934, the guns of the dictator Engelbert Dollfuss in Austria destroyed Red Vienna. And so, you know, for the communist democracies in popular democracy in the Soviet state, they already had an opinion that the Vienna, Red Vienna, was more pink than red.
Right.
And so there was a debate about that. But anyway, you know, already Machiavelli had said that prophets who are armed can resist and possibly prevail. Prophets who are disarmed go toward your ruin.
Right.
So, you know, it's a well-known idea that power comes from the barrel of a gun.
That's absolutely right. Yep.
Yeah, as Mao said. But nevertheless, it has to be said that the socialist administration of Vienna, and it was left, very left, in Otto Bauer, for example, and also liberal in a branch. But anyway, Vienna became the interwars, became the most extensive European experiment in municipal social democracy between the two wars. It was impressive. It was not a revolution, as the end showed, but I think it was a sort of utopian experiment that attracts people today who talk about politics are local, you know. The Social Democrats administration in Vienna had virtual sovereignty thanks to a 1921 constitutional provision that made Vienna an independent province. Just a fluke of the Republican switch from the monarchy to democracy in 1918.
Right.
Or, you know. So how did they do it? How did Vienna become Red Vienna? What did they do? Well, they introduced new taxes. And these taxes were imposed on luxury, on riding horses, on large private cars, on armies of servants in private households and in hotel rooms. So at a certain point, the municipality published a list of social institutions that could be financed by the servants' tax the Vienna branch of the Rothschild family had to pay. And they claimed that about 50% of their social services was financed by a luxury tax. Now, this was disbelieved. It was thought to be propagandist exaggeration, but recent historians have done research on the records in the municipal archives, and it was considerable, the luxury tax. The luxury tax contributed at least 36% to these benefits that accrued to the population.
So what we're talking about here is this, that, I mean, because the argument over whether or not it played a significant role boils down to, were these people making so much money that a tax on it could pay for half of the needs of the population? And the answer, more or less, they're starting to prove to those who didn't believe it, it was yes. That's how much money these rich people make.
That's right. Yes. And look at what happened. Look at what they did. They constructed 400 apartment complexes. Complexes, not 400 apartments.
Right.
64,000 new apartments in all. Hmm. Now, these housed one-tenth of the city's population. And the pride of Vienna and the symbol of the residential building program was the majestic Karl Marx Hof, the Karl Marx House. Hmm. And it was designed by a famous, a good modernist architect, Karl Lehn. Hmm. I wish I could remember to tell the audience to read an architectural book by an architectural expert of Red Vienna architecture, but they can easily look it up, and it contains the history as well.
Yeah.
And I was going to interject something else. Anyway, this Karl Marx Hof stretched and stretches because it's been refurbished lately. I don't know when, the last 20 years maybe. It stretched almost a mile along a railway line, which is significant. They still had to build in the working class suburbs,
right,
sections. These had to be, it was symbolic that it was people's power, but it was still at the edges of the city.
Right.
So it's still the longest, the major apartment complex in the world, Karl Marx Hof. If you ask anybody who goes to Vienna, they never heard of it, but they do conduct tours. You can look it up, and you can actually have a tour of Red Vienna architecture, but it's just not known. The Karl Marx Hof featured five great monumental archways, and they were constructed with a facade of red and yellow stucco, very appealing. It had interior courtyards, state-of-the-art kindergartens, playgrounds, maternity clinics, healthcare offices, lending libraries, laundries,
communities,
and other social services.
They were they were planned communities, and you had a green. The courtyards were had greens and everything. And here's the kicker: 4% of the household income was the rent. 4%.
Yeah, it's rather like Cuba.
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's about a tenth. Yeah, 4% of the household income, and in the private buildings it had been 30%. Now, they also passed in Red Vienna, just to digress for a second, a Tenant Protection Act. And the Tenant Protection Act froze rents because they had inflation of rents you know, like a big run up after the war, and it continued over the, you know, into the teens and 20s. They froze the rents at the level of 1914. So, first of all, new housing projects became unprofitable because they couldn't gouge anymore because of the rent control. Mm. And so they used a rental tax and a luxury tax to build Karl Marxhof. And because they did that and the costs were cheap, you had 4% income, and that drove down the price in the marketplace for the other part, for the private stuff, and you had the Tenant Protection Act to cap them anyway. So the housing went from taking a third to half or more of someone's income, like it does today, to 4%.
Amazing. Yeah. So in addition to these communal houses, and we must add, too, that there was a tremendous shortage of people housing, too, right? Yep. After the war. Right. I mean, we're talking about an empire.
That's right.
Isn't it peculiar that empires, the people at home, I mean, are so almost like their colonies?
Yep.
In other words, the metropolitan empire has masses of as poor people as those of the colonies that the empire exploits.
Internal colonies. That's, you know, Malcolm X spoke about that here with black folks. Yep,
Which is what is happening in the United States with the poverty rate, the unemployment, etc.
Yep.
Yeah. So in addition to communal houses, the Social Democrats instituted vacation grounds, recreational holidays, very much like the Soviet system, public baths and spas, sports facility, kindergartens and parks for children to play in. And all this had to do with hygiene and health, open air, exercise. It was basic. So the administration said, what we spend for youth homes, we will save on prisons. What we spend for the care of pregnant women and babies, we will save in hospital for mental illnesses. And, I mean, we have to note the similarity between what the Soviet government did when it could, starting in the 30s, and these people, they're doing the same things, but their defense against overthrow is not the same.
Right.
So, as a result, you know, medical services were free, tuberculosis dropped 50%. Parents, and this I think is the most significant, which is why I included a most telling action, parents got clothes packages for each
babies,
new baby.
Right. So they didn't have to be wrapped in a newspaper, which apparently was the practice.
Can you imagine?
Wow. That's a far cry from swaddling clothes, huh?
Uh-huh.
In a Catholic country.
And this is the empire, the capital of an empire that ruled all the way through Ukraine.
Yep.
And down south to Albania. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so, of course, infant mortality dropped to below the general Austrian average. Gas was affordable, electricity was affordable, garbage collection was affordable. And all this improved health standards. And the services were run by the state, by the municipal authorities. So, of course, as a result of this investment, the rate of unemployment in Vienna dropped in relation to the rest of Austria and Germany. As we mentioned, investments were financed by taxes, not by credits. So that the city administration stayed independent of creditors and did not have to pay interest on bonds. Interestingly, I was reading about China, Mao's China, and in spite of, you know, some of the misguided, supposedly, policies, by the end of the 60s, something like that, China had no debt.
No foreign debt.
That's one of the achievements of Mao. Yep. And it was the Soviet Union under Khrushchev, under Khrushchev, that demanded that China pay back in all sorts of things like pigs, the debt that Stalin had granted them.
Right.
And that was, you know, that's still a source of, I mean, they worked their butts off to pay back the Soviet Union, which wanted to be paid back to control China.
Yeah.
To be able to control policy. And then those were the bad years, 1960s, between, you know, that's Khrushchev is phase one of what we call the fall of capitalism, which was really an overthrow.
Yeah, of communism.
Fall of communism, I'm sorry, right.
That's right. And, you know, just to continue on digressing in that direction for a moment, the debt was also used to take that, you know, as further to take down the Warsaw Pact and ultimately the USSR. Because what happened was that the, you know, the financial institutions of the West began lending money to Poland and some of the other Eastern European countries.
Mm-hmm.
They used that money to, rather than to further develop their economies, they used it for political purposes to buy consumer goods. They essentially got people there, you know, hooked on Levi's and, you know, other products of the West, ended up with debt. And then suddenly, when they started pushing, they cut off the cash flow and they started activating their people on the ground, like Walesa and others. And those people had material complaints. Suddenly, I can't get any more Levi's or I can't get this or that. In addition to that, they used it to finance a separate, like a two-tier economy, which we've discussed a little bit, like talking about Cuba, for example, where they had the Berioska stores, where if you had Western currency, you could buy goods that would only be sold. They would not honor rubles. You couldn't buy anything with rubles from a Western economy because the Western economy wouldn't take it. So you had to get your hands on dollars. They would either be loaned from the West or people would come with dollars into it. And so they would buy, stock these stores that most people couldn't go to because they didn't have dollars. And it created all kinds of social unrest inside the country. And these were the seeds. Basically, debt and finance were, you know, some of the strongest influences that were used to take down the Soviet bloc.
I see. And then the next step was to destroy the Communist Party.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah, I saw it in Trieste, which is on the border of Yugoslavia. Mm. The people from Yugoslavia streaming in, buying Levi's to sell back in Yugoslavia, wearing three or four of them with on top dresses to get... In the 80s, this happened.
Right.
It was obvious.
Yep.
So they were being addicted to luxury, to these stupid, cheap luxury items.
Yeah. Same thing. When I was in Moscow in 1990, and I smoked Lark cigarettes. They're American cigarettes. So I could use a pack of American cigarettes to go in to get into one of the fanciest restaurants in Moscow, the Praga, down the Arbat, and you know, I could jump the head of the line, just holding it up to the door at the entrance, and for a carton, I could take 10 people out to dinner there. Well, I bought Russian cigarettes, Zavtra. There were few brands. While I was there, I was smoking those because I liked them better. It's just they were in cheesy packaging. They weren't all glitzed out and cellophane and all this other crap. But the tobacco was real tobacco,
right?
And they were better. And yet, you know, people get marketed these things and they're used as political weapons.
Amazing. It just, yes. And I think that we're digressing, but we're almost there because, you know, the next step to overthrow Vienna is the accession of power of Adolfo, so it's okay.
Right, yeah.
But... Yeah, in Cuba, I mean, I was told, it was already 1997, that Fidel Castro and his administration, his crew, became very worried about this opening of the second economy and dual monetary, you know, and having French bakeries selling goods that could be bought by... foreign currency, whatever, you know, and other things that it would cause this seduction
Right.
And so his answer was to simply blitz the country with programs on television on art and promoting arts, opening markets. I don't know if you saw the markets where I knew a couple in the university, and she, to earn money, she painted things and sold them at the market, you know? And suddenly there was this exuberance of artistic production, and the idea behind it was that if you could express yourself in art, not only, you know, could you earn the bread from tourists, but also you were, you made your own stuff.
Right.
Do you understand?
That's right.
In other words, art, not do you understand. Am I making myself clear?
No, I understand what you're saying. Yeah, no, I understand. Yeah,
What can we give them but the satisfaction of production in an artistic, way that would combat the seduction of these silly things?
Right. You have on the one hand, actual art, people's art, folk art, they can call it some of it, but some of it's a much higher level of development than bourgeois art even. And and on the other hand, you have, Campbell soup cans, with Andy Warhol and all Pomo stuff and all of that, which is used to market, commodities, basically. And I went, I did see this in Cuba, and I actually went to the home of José Rodríguez Fuster, who is one of Cuba's most famous artists. He has the whole neighborhood he has done in ceramics, and it's just massive. It's like a living art, the whole neighborhood. It feels
public art.
Yes, and public and private. Along the sidewalks, there are ceramic murals and all kinds of pools of, water, all kinds of things. You go into some houses like his house, he's the main artist there. He has almost a ceramic Sistine Chapel ceiling sort of thing. Only instead of, the two fingers that are touching, instead of one being high and one being low, they're side by side. Yeah. this kind of, like, socialist, communist, culture and public art, that kind of thing. So all right, let's go back, because we're down to about 7-8 minutes.
Okay.
So go ahead.
Okay. So, we're at the point where things change and Red Vienna is eliminated. So in 1933, and by 1934, Red Vienna was crushed because what followed was Austrofascism. And the man who installed it was this guy, Engelbert Dollfuss, who, if you look at the pictures, was very, very short. So they called him Milli Metternich. Metternich.
Yes.
19th century. And so Milli, meaning Milli,
yeah,
Milli Metternich.
Mini me.
And so anyway, he was an ardent Catholic and a member of the Social Christian Party, which we talked about being very conservative. Yeah. A throwback to before the 1789 revolution. I mean, the whole 19th century, as far as the Catholic Church was concerned, I'm not so sure about the Protestant, but as far as the Vatican, it was a counter-reformation again, like a second counter-reformation.
Right.
The Vatican recalled the election of bishops in local places, for example.
Right.
The investment had to come from Rome. I mean, they fought like fiends in the 19th century, the Vatican, not to lose their power.
Right.
Anyway, he had an unremarkable career. He's a typical bureaucrat of a party, except for his staunch support for the conservative party. And of course, he had clerical connections at the high level.
Right.
These Vienna bishop has always been a maker of popes anyway.
Right. This was the home of the empire. This was the home of what came out of the Holy Roman Empire. So, this was the European and, the Southwest Asian Empire.
Whatever the Bishop of Vienna was during the John Paul, second? Pope, the Polish Pope, Wojtyla.
Yes. Yeah.
I mean, that Fischer, I think, was his name, Bishop of Vienna, had everything to do with Wojtyla's election.
Absolutely.
I mean, Wojtyla wasn't even a preferential, a major choice.
Yeah, they practically appointed him. And so now we're talking about transitioning from Red Vienna to Austrofascism, which is Roman Catholic, and then a few short years later, that's supplanted by Pan-Germanic fascism, or the Nazi Party, basically, the Germans, Hitler, and Protestant.
Yep. Yeah. That's what we're talking about. By 1932, Engelbert gets into the parliament, and we have, it's so minute, but we have the same pattern we had in Italy and all other fascism. It's a coup. The liberals play dead. Somebody... Right. And these strong men step into the role. Now, do we have time to go into this?
Yeah, we have. We have 3 minutes.
You summarized it well. So Red Vienna by 1932, Dollfuss, this little man, is in power. By 1933 is the crucial year. Constitution suspended, legislation suspended. About 200,000 Jews lose the vote. About 177,000 of mixed race lose the vote. And this is 33, it's the watershed year where Austrofascism actually happens and takes power. And by 1934, in February, there is a three-day uprising, and the symbolic action is that Dollfuss calls in, not the symbolic, the actual action is the calls in the army to bomb Karhoff House, which is, that is symbolic, and calls in the army in the Vienna municipality. We have to remember that Austria had been a federation of, I think, four sections, I'm not sure, but this federation had been dissolved by Dollfuss and centralized into his hands. So Vienna lost its sovereignty, and Dollfuss called in the army and Hofhaus and others, of course, and was bombarded and damaged. And then what follows in every fascism, you get suspensions of civil rights.
They dissolved the Communist Party of Austria in May of 1933, the Socialist Workers' Party in June. Then they get down to what was called the Free Thinkers Guild in June after they get rid of the communists. Then they go after where the Social Democrats were in Linz in February of 1934. And by May Day, ironically enough, they proclaim the May Constitution, and they take down Republic out of the name, and it's now a federal state, and they're building essentially an authoritarian structure.
Yes. And the difference between them, Austrofascists, and the Austro-Nazis is the two things. One, they didn't agree on the unification with Germany, which had been forbidden by the Versailles Treaty anyway. And the second thing is that Dollfuss's party identified itself as Catholic.
You know, the divergence is, essentially a product of the divergent histories of each of these places and the social expectations.
And one of the things we also need to talk about is the role of the church as it becomes so prominent in the Austrofascism, and also how fascism makes these alliances with the church, as in Italy. I mean, Mussolini was an atheist. He didn't care about religion. And yet he had to make, and he made a peace with the Vatican, which was devastating because it required compensation. The Vatican demanded compensation for losing the lands of Italy that he had formerly controlled.
Right.
He agreed that.
Yep. Okay, and we'll pick up there next week. Lucia,
yeah,
thank
we'll
you
talk
very
about
much.
The church, and then we'll go on to the other fascism.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you. My pleasure. Bye-bye.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.